You're listening to Real World News.
Organizations defend people's agreement on climate change. We are in Cancun to defend the Cochabamba Agreement, the perspective, the analysis, the alternatives, and the demands that came out of the Cochabamba Summit really reflect very well the view of our organization and many of our allies and friends. This is what activist Nicola Bullard from Focus on the Global South said in an interview with Real World Radio last week at the COP16 on climate change, which will end on Friday the 10th. The activist made reference to the People's Agreement, which came out as a result of the World People's Conference on Climate Change and the Rights of Mother Earth in April 2010 in Cochabamba, Bolivia. Focus on the Global South is a non-governmental organization based in Bangkok, Thailand. It combines policy research, advocacy, activism, and grassroots capacity building in order to generate critical analysis and encourage debates on national and international policies related to corporate-led globalization, neoliberalism, and militarization. Bullard said she was happy because Bolivia brought the People's Agreement to the official climate negotiations a few months ago, but was disappointed with the continuous attempts to get rid of the Cochabamba language in the negotiation texts. The member of Focus on the Global South said that it is necessary to defend the legitimacy of the voices of the peoples. The activist also made reference to the work of the social movements outside the official framework of the UN and the need to bring the voices of the people into the negotiations. Let's now listen to Nicola Bullard.
Real World Radio is interviewing Nicola Bullard from Focus on the Global South, present here in Cancun in this new COP on climate change of the United Nations. Nicola, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Nicola, what are the main expectations of Focus on the Global South regarding this new COP in Cancun?
I guess we're here really to defend the Cochabamba Agreement. I think that for Focus and for many of the groups that we work with, the perspective, the analysis, the alternatives and the demands that came out of the Cochabamba Climate Summit really reflect very well the perspective of our organisation and many of our allies and friends. So we were, of course, very happy in Tianjin to see that some of the key demands or the key elements of the Cochabamba text had been included in the negotiation text. Of course, in brackets, but at least some of the ideas are there. And of course, it's very disappointing to see now in the negotiations in the long-term cooperative action working group that there is a clear attempt to get rid of the Cochabamba language out of the text. So I think for us, on the inside and on the outside, we're really here to defend the Cochabamba Agreement, to defend the process and the legitimacy of the voices of the people, and to see how we can actually build the movement on the outside, how we can build the alliances and the perspective and the interrelations between the different movements on the outside, and how we can actually bring those voices and that perspective into the negotiations.
Nicola, what parts of the People's Agreement from the Cochabamba Summit in April this year would you strengthen more?
In terms of the negotiations?
In terms of the alternatives that this agreement tried to put forward to these negotiations.
Yeah. Well, I think for me the key thread that runs through the Cochabamba Agreement, which is absolutely critical, is this very strong rejection of market mechanisms, and particularly carbon markets and offsets. I think that is really the fatal flaw that we saw in the Kyoto Protocol, this introduction of the ever neoliberal thinking into the climate negotiations. So I think that what the Cochabamba Accord does very well in many different ways is to really challenge this market logic, this idea that we can actually leave environmental management to financial markets and to the private sector. So I think that those elements which actually challenge the carbon markets and challenge this idea of offsets are really important. And specifically, for example, the demand that the Annex 1 countries reduce their emissions by 50% by 2017 with no offsets. That's absolutely fundamental, because at the moment the rich countries are able to basically outsource their pollution to the rest of the world without making any changes domestically. And so in terms of the environment, it's a disaster. In terms of the impact on the South, it's a disaster. So I think that really the thing we have to push very, very hard is to get rid of any of these market mechanisms. And we've seen here that the debate on the RED, the mechanism to reduce deforestation, is incredibly complex. And I think and it's an incredibly hot and divisive issue. But I think really at the heart of that, of course, everyone knows we have to protect the forests. That is what we have to do. Protect the forest, protect the communities who depend on the forests, protect the rights of the Indigenous people. And what we have to do is to de-link forest protection from building up carbon markets. So for me, the carbon market is really the heart of the problem.
Okay, Nicola, I know that Focus on the Global South was a bit concerned on the role of some developing countries like Brazil, India, South Africa, which are part of the G77 plus China here in these negotiations. But at the same time, they supported last year they were pushed maybe by the United States, but they supported this Copenhagen Accord with the false solutions and the absolutely not enough emission reductions, and also in terms of climate finance, it was really a weak agreement accorded by just a few countries there in Copenhagen. But again, this China, Brazil, India, they played a role with pushing for this accord also. How do you see in Focus on the Global South these different roles of these developing countries?
Well, first of all, I think that the Copenhagen Accord wouldn't have even seen the light of day, right? It wouldn't have got out of the room that it was in if it hadn't been for the support of the big developing countries, the big emerging economies. I think that we'll never know to what extent they were pushed or they were willingly part of building up the Copenhagen Accord. But I think that we've seen that at least in the past 12 months, that there's been a very contradictory position on the part of China and India and Brazil. On the one hand, they are very happy to be part of the G20. They're very happy to be part of this sort of powerful clique of countries that are trying to, you know, organise the economic system for the whole planet. And just a couple of weeks ago in Korea, all of the G20 countries signed on to a declaration which, on the one hand, supported the UN FCCC process, but at the same time supported the Copenhagen Accord. And I think they're completely contradictory because they're based on completely different models of how you actually approach the question of emission reductions. We know the UN FCCC is based on a model of historical responsibility with a clear legal commitment that the Annex 1 countries, who are responsible historically for the majority of greenhouse gas emissions, should be the first ones to take the cuts, and they should also be the countries who make the money available for the non-Annex 1 countries to make the necessary steps to move to cleaner energy systems, etc. But at the same time, so this is a legally binding process which has, you know, if you like, a kind of a top-down mandated legally binding process inside the UN, inside the Kyoto Protocol, with a lot of criticisms of markets, etc. Copenhagen Accord, on the other hand, is completely voluntary. Everyone puts up their hand and said, oh, yeah, I'm happy to do a 10% reduction, or no, the economy's really bad this year, we'll only do a 5% reduction, or we actually saved a lot of forests in the last 10 years, so in fact we'll expand our greenhouse gas emissions. So it's completely voluntary. It's got nothing to do with the scientific data. It's got nothing to do with the principles of equity. It's got nothing to do with justice. And there is no compelling requirement in the Copenhagen Accord for anyone to do anything. So basically, all of the big emitters get off the hook, whether it's the US or China, they all get off the hook. So in that sense, I think that the Copenhagen Accord was a kind of win-win for the big emitting economies, because it basically gives them a way to more or less do what they want and just make an agreement amongst each other. And really to say, we don't care about Bolivia, we don't care about Tuvalu, we don't care about the sub-Saharan countries in Africa who are going to be completely devastated by droughts. We don't care about anyone. So I think all of these big, rich countries have been extremely self-interested. I think they're really looking after their own trade interests, their own economic interests. They're not showing any kind of leadership in terms of assuming responsibilities. And I think that I do see a kind of duplicity or hypocrisy in some of the big developing countries who are on the one hand supporting the Copenhagen Accord and at the same time will come out with very fine statements in the name of the G77 and China. But they're not really, you know, it's like a game. It's a game that is very much about defending their own interests, and in the end we all lose because it does nothing about really addressing the real systemic causes of climate change, which is the economic model that we have at the moment, which is really the big driver of climate change.
Nicola, at the same time, in 2 days we'll be beginning the activities organized by La Via Campesina, the Mexican organizations which are working together here in Cancun, trying to put forward what they consider the real solutions to climate change. So first I would ask you if you are going to take part in these activities, the demonstrations outside, and then, in your opinion, what are the real solutions to climate change?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, yes, the small team of us here from Focus will be participating in all of the different activities. And I really would like to add here that for many of the climate activists in Southeast Asia, in Philippines, Indonesia, Thailand, they decided to put their priority in the Thousand Cancuns. Okay, so in fact, while we're here in Cancun, back in different provinces and cities of Thailand and the Philippines and Indonesia and India, there are a whole lot of actions that are taking place in this sort of global, in the frame of the global call for a thousand Cancuns. So, but those of us who are here, we're going to be at the SMEX, we're going to be part of the Via Campesina activities. And I think that first, as said earlier, I think we have to really go after the carbon markets. I think that this is, in terms of our alternatives, we have to really hone in on what is the one of the key problems here. And one of the key problems here is the commodification of all of nature, because this is the way things are going. And I think that the alternatives are not that complex, actually. I mean, in the sense, if we look, for example, at Via Campesina, the model of agriculture that is strongly advocated and practiced by the Via Campesina members is clearly a model of agriculture which can really transform the capacity of the soil to absorb carbon dioxide, its water-bearing capacity, its productivity. It can increase biodiversity. It can help increase the transport systems, because it's a much more localized production. So, you know, we acknowledge that agriculture as a sector is an important contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. But this is the industrial agriculture which is producing all of those greenhouse gas emissions through incredible use of fertilizers, through incredible use of transport, through having monocultures which destroy biodiversity and degrade the soils. So it's obvious, it's so obvious that a different agricultural system would really turn things around in a very dramatic way. So it's not difficult in science, theoretically it's not difficult. Of course, what is difficult is the politics and the big corporations that are standing in the way of us and a sensible, rational and human agricultural system. I think if we talk about transport, if we talk about a whole lot of other sectors, we can see the same problems there, that there are interest groups like car companies, like, you know, huge construction firms, like, you know, engineering companies that build enormous hydro dams, the coal exporters. There are all of these very important interest groups that are standing in the way of us, the big us, people who are affected by climate change and really struggling for change, and the change that we need to happen. So it's not that there is an absence of alternatives. We know what needs to be done, but what is stopping us from doing that is the interests of the corporations, the misguided economic policies of the rich countries, and the fact that small developing countries have very little capacity for autonomous action, because we're all trapped in this globalised neoliberal economy. We're trapped by trade rules, we're trapped by the dictates of the International Monetary Fund, we're trapped with the power of the financial markets and the corporate power. So we cannot extract this climate reality, the climate problem, from the larger economic system that we're living in. So we have to build a movement that has to, you know, really take on, try and build a political power which can challenge the entrenched power of the corporations and the financial markets. I'm not optimistic that we can do that, frankly, because even with this huge economic crisis that's affecting Europe, I mean, day by day, you know, the countries in Europe are being attacked by the financial markets. The US economy is in a terrible state, with poor people really being very badly affected by that. And in the face of all of this social hardship that's caused, we're still unable to do anything. It's still the financial markets that are basically forcing governments to reduce their budget deficits and, you know, etc. So at the moment I feel this sort of, we're stuck, you know. We can see the problems, we know what needs to be done, but somehow we don't have the political tools, right, to make those changes, which is why I think so many of us are giving so much support to Bolivia, right? Because Bolivia is a kind of an important symbol of a country that has a vision, has a political strategy, is willing to speak out on these issues against all of the odds. So I think that for us, you know, so long as there's Bolivia and a few other countries who are willing to speak truth to power, we can support them and hope for some change in the future.
Okay, Nicola Boulard from Focus on the Global South. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Real World News.